Good evening. You are listening to the Elchar Chronicles. I am your host, Karen Elchar. This program chronicles issues of law and order and our local justice system, the environment, and Indigenous history with special guests that dig deep into topics less talked about here in the Lehigh Valley. I'm very pleased to welcome back this evening's guest, Stephanie Wine, clean water and conservation advocate with Penn Environment. Hello, Stephanie.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, as clean water and conservation advocate, Stephanie runs the organization's water and conservation programs, which involves leading campaigns to eradicate lead in drinking water, protecting pollinators, defending the Clean Water Act, and spearheading state legislative priorities. So before we go into this evening's issues, Stephanie, could you give a brief overview of Penn Environment and the organization's mission, activities, etc.?
Sure. So Penn Environment is a statewide citizen-based environmental nonprofit, and our job is to make sure the voices of Pennsylvanians are heard on environmental issues at a state, at a local, and a federal level. And so we know that most Pennsylvanians, they want to trust the water coming out of their tap. They want fewer smog days. They want real solutions to climate change. They want their parks open and funded. But it takes a lot of work to raise those voices, be it in city councils and borough councils across the state, in Harrisburg, and in Washington. And so we work on a pretty wide suite of environmental issues, whether that's working with the city of Reading to phase out single-use plastic, working with Allegheny County to keep fracking out of state parks, or working in Harrisburg on everything from clean energy to protecting wildlife.
You are doing a lot, and I've seen so many of your press releases. It's phenomenal. Thank you.
Thanks.
So with that background, you recently advised there has been progress on two topics of particular interest, namely a ban on the use of PFAS chemicals, and second, the establishment of wildlife corridors. So let's first address the wildlife corridors. You and I had our first discussion on this issue with Pennsylvania State Representative Mary Jo Daly way back in June of 2023, and then you gave an update again in 2024. So here there's been significant action moving forward on this issue. So remind us, what are wildlife corridors and how does this issue affect wildlife as well as people?
Sure. So wildlife corridors are it's a broad term for a category of solutions to help wildlife navigate our fragmented landscape. And so Pennsylvania has an incredible environment. We have everything from our bear and elk and bobcat to the billions of songbirds that migrate across the Commonwealth every year, but their habitat is cut apart by whether it's our roads or our energy infrastructure like pipelines and power corridors to expanding subdivisions and suburban development. There's all these challenges to our wildlife as they try to navigate that landscape, and that's a phenomenon called habitat fragmentation. And habitat fragmentation has a lot of consequences. And the one that listeners are probably most familiar with is the fact that we are number one for animal vehicle collisions in the country. No state files more claims for animal vehicle collisions than Pennsylvania does. It's usually like a 1 in 50 chance you have in Pennsylvania on a given year of having an accident with an animal so bad you actually have to take up with your insurance. And at the same time, there's these other costs that are a little more invisible to our wildlife beyond, you know, becoming a roadkill, that are things like separating populations so they can't breed with each other. We know that when you put a highway in and you have bobcats that can no longer cross that highway and mate with each other, those populations have inbreeding. They get less healthy. They're less resistant to disease, and both of those new smaller populations decline. So it's a barrier to migration. Every spring, Pennsylvania's salamanders and frogs come out of the forest to go to their ponds to breed every year on those first warm nights in March. And it only takes a few cars on a given night on a rural road to have 80% mortality of salamanders. And so our infrastructure causes these real barriers to population health, breeding, and long-term to climate resiliency. as wildlife populations are moving north in search of cooler climates and climate refugia, our wildlife can only do that and seek new and more suitable climates as our world warms if they can access those places. And so having a connected landscape to be more climate resilient is something that it's another thing that's challenged by having fragmented habitat. And Pennsylvania plays a really critical part of not only where this is going to be a landscape that a lot of animals throughout the South and Southern Appalachia are going to move north through, but also every spring and fall, we're a critical part of bird migration. And so having stepping stones, those rest stops for songbirds and for raptors as they move north every spring and south every fall, having connected habitat has a lot of implications for our wildlife. And so how do we make it easier for our wildlife to navigate all the barriers that we've thrown up and to knit back together the patchwork we have of remaining wilderness? And so that's a pretty big question. And so it can look like wildlife crossings. So sometimes bridges, but in Pennsylvania more often tunnels, underpasses, or stormwater culverts to let animals move under our roads. But it's also a land management question. How is the DCNR and the Game Commission stewarding their public land? How are local land conservancies managing their land as part of the larger matrix of habitat across the Commonwealth and across the region? Pennsylvania was a little bit behind in taking that 10,000-foot view of how are we planning Commonwealth-wide for habitat connectivity and addressing habitat fragmentation.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we discussed this with the state representative. She had also mentioned at the time that she was working diligently to get this project, to get this issue addressed. And at that time, I know there was movement in the Pennsylvania State House of Representatives. So what's transpired since then? I mean, it's an extremely important issue for everyone. Yes, the wildlife and the environment, and also people, as you mentioned, is, you know, people coming up against the wildlife when they're driving along. I mean, look at the roads today. Same thing. You know, you have deer populations and smaller animals as well lying on the sides of the streets.
Yeah, so I'm excited to talk to you now because I come with really good news, which is that the governor announced this month that we are officially convening a working group of all the relevant state agencies to come together and do wildlife corridor planning for the state of Pennsylvania. And so the resolution you mentioned in 2023, we wanted to get the state to begin to look critically at what the gaps and opportunities were in terms of habitat fragmentation. And so Representative Daley, along with her counterpart, Jason Ortitai, a Republican from Western Pennsylvania, drafted a resolution that directed the state to study sort of, okay, what are we doing and what are we missing? You know, what are other states doing and what can we learn from them? And that was House Resolution 87. It passed with wide bipartisan support, and the resulting study came out the following year in 2024. Its big recommendation was this exact thing, that, okay, our agencies are actually doing a lot on their own, which we know. You know, PennDOT has installed some wildlife crossings. The DCNR has a conservation landscape program for places like the Kittatinny Ridge that is really focused on habitat connectivity. The Game Commission is doing great work to reconnect cerulean warbler habitats in the Harrisburg area and reconnect fragmented wood rat populations in the Allegheny Mountains. But a lot of that work is happening in isolation, and it's not the agencies aren't doing that planning together. And so what we need is to change how our agencies do their long-term planning. And the best example was that PennDOT repaves about 4,000 miles of roads a year. And there was this case study we found when we were sort of digging into examples of what we could do better in Fayette County, Western Pennsylvania, where this road was going to be redone through a sensitive habitat. The Indian Creek Reservoir in Fayette County near Normalville is listed by the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources as a sort of a sensitive and priority and unique habitat. The Fish and Boat Commission, which is the agency that stewards our reptiles and amphibians, knows that there's a bunch of rare turtles, and there's amphibians whose populations are threatened in that area. And so we have three different agencies. PennDOT's going to repave a road. The DCNR knows it's a sensitive habitat with rare plants and a unique wetland. The Fish and Boat Commission knows that there's reptiles and amphibians there that need protection. But none of those agencies were talking to each other. And because state workers actually saw a lot of reptile and amphibian mortality when they went to the site, I think they happened to be there in March, and so they actually saw that there was roadkill. They then, working with the Fish and Boat Commission, were able to get culverts put in place, and there wasn't much mortality seen in the, when they returned to the site. And it really solved that problem. But imagine if we were doing that proactively. And that's the vision for this new working group, that the right hand of the state knows what the left hand is doing. And all of those agencies that have this footprint, that manage millions of acres of public land and thousands of miles of roadways and all of our hundreds of wild species, now working in concert to identify what the priority places are for habitat connectivity, what are the most needed projects, and having a framework for the conservancies that do a lot of this work already, from the nonprofits that steward a lot of land themselves, have a lot of knowledge and research, as well as local governments who deal with problems like roadkill and land management, and to have a framework for them to engage as well. And so we're really excited that it is a new approach to conservation planning in Pennsylvania, and I am extremely excited to see it get off to the races.
Oh, I agree. Very, very exciting. Let me also ask a question regarding funding. When we did our interview previously, there was new federal funding in Pennsylvania, $840,000 federal money for interagency strategic planning. Is there an update on that? Is that the money that's being used for really looking at these wildlife corridors?
That's a great question, and it's two great things are happening at the same time. And so that grant came from the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which former President Biden had supported and signed into law in 2021. And it included for the very first time this program called the Wildlife Crossings Pilot Program that gave money to states to either do this planning, because again, you know, we hadn't done any of that planning, or states that are a bit ahead of us to actually build more of these projects. And so we got that grant. It was specifically PennDOT and the Game Commission, I believe, to start doing some of that specific planning, but it was very transportation focused. And so what is exciting about this working group approach is that it is not just about the roadkill, it is not just about the accidents, it's not just about, you know, getting the deer across the road and getting the bear across the road. It's actually about land management, it's about habitat more broadly, it's about things like dam removal. You know, Pennsylvania leads the nation for low head dams, which are those really, the low dams you can't really see from the road, but they, most of them don't serve a purpose anymore, and they're big barriers to fish migration, and they really are sort of a menace to us having healthy trout populations in Pennsylvania, which is such a great state to fish. And so that initial grant is helping do some of the planning around crossings specifically, but the working group is taking a much larger view of what it means to conserve ecosystems and preserve species and reconnect habitat. But we want that federal funding to continue. That the Wildlife Crossings Pilot Program actually expires in September, and the problem of animal vehicle collisions won't have gone away, not here in Pennsylvania, not anywhere. And so Congress is in the process right now of reauthorizing the Surface Transportation Bill. It does that every 5 years. And so this is the opportunity to reauthorize and refund the Wildlife Crossings Program for the next 5 years. Of course, Pennsylvania would love to be able to tap into additional resources. So we've been down in D.C. doing a bunch of advocacy around that. And we're excited that so far that there is funding included, not as much as we'd like, but there's a significant chunk of funding, and the program looks like so far there's a lot of excitement to reauthorize it. So hopefully we can reauthorize this federal program, and that will help the work that we're setting out to do here in Pennsylvania.
Let me ask a follow-up question. Is there anything that our listeners can actually do to help move that process along?
I mean, I think reaching out to members of Congress to reiterate that this is a program that we want to see. I think Pennsylvania's congressional delegation is going to play a key role in making sure that we reauthorize wildlife crossings. You know, our tagline is wildlife crossings save lives. It's true of animals, it's true of people. These are costly, dangerous accidents, and no one knows that better than Pennsylvanians. And so folks continuing to encourage both our senators and to encourage other members of Congress, letting their members of Congress know that this is something they support, that always goes a really long way. They're polite when I meet with them, but they want to hear from their voters. And so the more that people reach out, that makes our job a lot easier.
Excellent. Oh, it's so nice to hear that things are moving forward. So we need to take a brief break. So you are listening to the AlChart Chronicles with my guest, Stephanie Wine, with Penn Environment. And we're going to discuss two specific issues. We've just heard about wildlife corridors, and coming up next is the progress on a ban of PFAS chemicals. Do stay tuned.
Are you saying out with the old, in with the new when it comes to your old car? WDIY's vehicle donation program will turn your ride into your favorite programs on Lehigh Valley Public Radio. The towing is free, all the paperwork is taken care of, and your gift is tax deductible. For more information, call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or visit wdiy.org.
Welcome back to the AlChart Chronicles. If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephanie Wine, clean water and conservation advocate with Penn Environment. Previously, we were discussing wildlife corridors. Now let's turn to a different topic. Our other topic is a sought-after ban on PFAS chemicals. And Stephanie, you first brought this issue to our listeners' attention in 2024, and there's been movement on this issue, and so I do believe congratulations are in order.
We're getting there. Not quite across the finish line, but we're making progress. PFAS is a catch-all term for the category of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, which is this broad class of chemicals with a wide suite of commercial and industrial uses. They have some pretty serious health impacts. People are exposed to them basically in two ways, either through our drinking water or through products that we use in our homes. The drinking water, the way that they've been really entering our environment is through their use over the last couple decades in firefighting foam. And so PFAS is really good at putting out a fire. And so it's in Class B firefighting foam, which is used in fighting a bunch of different types of fires. In areas where you see repeated use of firefighting foam, like military bases, like fire training academies, like the one in Emmaus, is where you see over time this foam really built up in the groundwater. Obviously, the workers have had a lot of exposure, but it also enters the water table. And so the canary in the coal mine was really the Willow Grove Air Force Base on the Bucks-Montgomery County line in southeastern Pennsylvania. They were finding PFAS levels in the parts per billion, which may sound small, but this is a chemical that can cause health impacts in the parts per trillion. And so there were orders and orders of magnitude higher levels of PFAS in the groundwater in this community in Pennsylvania. And once the problem was noticed in Willow Grove, it sort of was this tip of a toxic iceberg, that the more communities, whether it was around military bases or firefighting training academies or sites of big historic fires. And so the Burgie Tire Fire in northern Bucks County back, I think, in the 80s, it burned for 3 days. It took firefighting units from all over the region to help put it out. And so much firefighting foam was used to put out the fire that decades later, in the 2010s, nearby communities realized that their wells were poisoned by a firefighting incident that had happened decades ago. And this is why you might also hear them referred to as forever chemicals. They are really persistent. They hang out in our environment, and they don't really break down. So they build up in our environment, they build up in our bodies, and can have this wide suite of health impacts. Some of the things that we see associated with PFAS are rare kidney cancers and all sorts of kidney problems. We see reproductive issues. issues with thyroid, so thyroid cancers and other thyroid disorders, infertility. There's it's also now been associated with preeclampsia, which is one of the number one causes of maternal mortality in the U.S. It's a high blood pressure disorder that occurs in pregnancy. We've been working for years to try to get drinking water standards, to get our water authorities to limit the amount of PFAS, to start treating PFAS at the water authority, so that if you're on municipal water, we're testing for PFAS, we're filtering for PFAS. Pennsylvania has some standards. There were new federal standards rolled out during the last administration, though those are currently being challenged. And that's all great that we're now cleaning up our drinking water sources. If you're on a municipal tap, we have these new protections that are being put into place. But if you know this pollutant is widespread in the environment, you can't just be treating it at the drinking water source. You need to stop putting it out there in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so we, in addition to the work that we've been doing over the years in terms of trying to protect our drinking water from PFAS at the tap, we also have been working to phase out the sources of PFAS in the environment, and that first and foremost has been our work to phase it out of firefighting foam.
And you've also recently advised that there's a bill moving forward.
Yes, so we've been excited to support the incredible work of the Firefighters Union working to get PFAS out of firefighting foam. This is led by the incredible men and women of the International Association of Firefighters. They deal with the brunt of this toxic chemical first and foremost because they are responding to these scenes. They are being bathed in firefighting solvents, and they're bearing the brunt. I mean, the number one cause of death in the line of duty for firefighters now isn't burns or building collapses or, you know, all the sort of things you think of with responding to a fire emergency, but it's cancers. It's all these cancers. And Representative Monroe from Willow Grove, he actually himself has dealt with two different cancers as a volunteer fireman. And so he has seen firsthand the impact that these chemicals can have. And so it's a matter of first responder health and then also water health. This session, a bill to phase PFAS out of firefighting foam passed the Pennsylvania House unanimously. We don't do a lot of things unanimously in Pennsylvania anymore. This is something everyone can support. But that was last summer, and it was still until recently waiting for action by the Pennsylvania Senate. And so it just passed a committee unanimously in the Pennsylvania Senate, and so we're hoping that the Pennsylvania Senate will bring up this bill that clearly everyone's behind to get it over the finish line. Florida just a few days ago passed something similar to phase out PFAS in firefighting foam, and so this would make us the 16th state.
So the bill that's going forward, does that also cover then use of PFAS in baby personal care products and the like?
What a great segue. I mentioned that we're exposed in two ways. You and me went out in the world. PFAS enters our bodies in two different ways. One is this PFAS foam enters the water table and is in the environment, and that's mostly through this firefighting and industrial use. And then the other way is the products that we actually bring into our homes. PFAS, because it is really very effective at being fire-resistant, but also it is water-resistant. It is stain resistant, it is grease resistant, it is non-stick, and so it has for decades, often before some of the health impacts were really known, especially by the general public, into a ton of consumer products. So whether that's your non-stick pan to your carpet or your couch that's been advertised as, you know, stain resistant or wipes clean, the chemicals that make it really good at doing that are often part of that PFAS family. And so we have a lot of that just sort of embedded in a lot of popular consumer products. And so there was a bill last year to follow states like Maine and Minnesota that have actually moved towards phasing out PFAS from consumer products completely, a really broad proposal. This session, there was a slightly different approach that leaders in Harrisburg took, which is picking out products that are used sort of by uniquely vulnerable Pennsylvanians and in uniquely personal ways. And that's baby products and then a set of personal care products. So cosmetics, menstrual products, and dental floss, things we use in really intimate ways with our bodies and that the scientific literature has shown provide a lot of avenues for our bodies to absorb those chemicals. When I knew that there were PFAS in a lot of infant products, but it really was when I myself was expecting my daughter, and you know, you're building your baby registry and you're figuring out what things you want in your home to care for your new baby, and my goodness, so many of those products have PFAS in them. Baby pajamas often have it in them to make them flame retardant. It's in bedding to make it, unless otherwise specified, to make it flame retardant. It's in carpeting that you might be putting down on the floor. Babies' bodies are uniquely vulnerable to these chemicals because their systems are still developing. And there's a study that in daycare centers that had PFAS in the carpet versus not, you have infants that are taking up more of that PFAS-containing dust because they spend so much time on the floor. They're putting everything in their mouths. And so it's just really important specifically that juvenile products be held to a higher standard of safety, and that made sense to us as one of the first places to start with the phase-out of these toxic chemicals.
So right now, House Bill 2145, based on the information you had provided me, that passed with bipartisan support, 188-13 was the vote. So right now, so the State House has approved or basically passed it. So it's sitting in the State Senate at this point?
Yeah, another bill that's before the State Senate. We were really excited to see it pass the House again with not quite unanimous, but just really broad bipartisan support. It just seems so obvious, but when I'm standing in the line at the grocery store to figure out what diapers to buy, I shouldn't be needing to worry if the diapers I'm bringing home to care for my child are full of toxic chemicals that could harm their development. Our parents are burdened with enough choices. This shouldn't be one more thing we have to think about. And so, yeah, this 2145, yeah, it's infant products, menstrual care products, because you also see PFAS in pads and tampons. Those are particularly absorptive parts of the body. So much can go across those membranes, and so chemicals that can mess with our hormones and compromise our health. And then cosmetics we're applying, you know, daily to our skin. I shouldn't need to worry if the lipstick I'm putting on right on my mouth is going to potentially have harmful toxins in it. And dental floss, which we're putting in our mouths. And, you know, if your gums bleed, you know, PFAS, it's got like direct access to your bloodstream. There are other ways to make dental floss slippery. These seem to be products that we thought folks could agree on, and a really good first step into phasing out these chemicals broadly.
With the bipartisan support that was listed here in the press release, like I said, it was 188 in support of, you know, removing PFAS and those items. I can't see that the State Senate would vote otherwise, you know?
Yeah.
Where can our listeners find more information on both of these topics, the wildlife corridors, as well as the ban on toxic PFAS?
Right on our website, the front page is going to be about the new stuff happening on wildlife corridors, as well as some great pictures of critters. We have a report from last year with case studies about all the good stuff that's already happening with wildlife corridors on our homepage. And then we also have some updates on what's happening with PFAS. It's a great resource on, you know, whatever your environmental interest, be that what's going on with clean energy right now or what's happening with endangered species. We try to make that site a resource.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything else you'd like to mention?
On that, I did say at the beginning that the drinking water standards that were proposed in the last administration and the rules that are going to require all our municipal authorities to limit PFAS in our drinking water are now being proposed to be walked back and to limit the number of PFAS chemicals that are going to be tested for at our water authorities. This is a broad class of chemicals, and we want the strongest protections for our drinking water possible. Folks reaching out in support of keeping a strong rule on PFAS you know, at the state level, we see that limiting PFAS has bipartisan support. We strongly suggest people reaching out. You can make a public comment and then reaching out to members of Congress that if we lose the federal rule around drinking water, then, you know, we need to pass a law. We need to close this loophole. We need to make sure that we protect our drinking water from the PFAS that's already in the environment, while at the same time taking the necessary steps to limit the sources of PFAS entering the environment.
Mm-hmm. So my guest has been Stephanie Wine, clean water and conservation advocate with Penn Environment, discussing forward movement, significant progress on establishment of wildlife corridors, as well as a bill to ban toxic PFAS in baby and personal care products. Congratulations, Stephanie. Keep up the good work. Thank you for all of your support and everything that you're doing to further both of these issues. So thank you so much for being with us and providing us an update.
Thanks for having me. Always happy to talk. And if anyone has any questions, they always should reach out to Penn Environment. We're around and we want to hear from people.
This is Karen Elchar. Thank you for tuning in to WDIY, and we'll see you next time on the Elchar Chronicles.